is Americana. America is the place of the fast approach, the hot, blind, smoky passage, the tragic, lonely beauty of New England, and the web of Boston. The place of the mighty station there and the engines, passive as great cats. The straight, dense plumes of engine smoke, the acrid and exciting smell of trains and stations, and of the man swarm passing ever in its million-footed weft. The smell of the sea in harbors, and the thought of voyages. The place of the goat cry, the strong joy of our youth. The magic city when we knew the most fortunate life on earth would certainly be ours. That we were 20 and could never die.
The words you have just heard were written by Thomas Wolfe in his novel of Time and the River. This program is Americana, the 17th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Getting From Here to There.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. There are certain things about the book publishing business in the United States which are almost completely predictable. One safe bet, for example, is that every season American publishers will produce at least three or four books which have to do with the means of travel, of getting from one place to another. Why this is, I'm not entirely sure. We're either an extremely mobile people or we like to think we are. And if our national restlessness is a legend, it's one which seems to be shared by the aliens in our midst. I don't think that I've ever read a book about life in the United States written by a foreigner which didn't comment at some length on American railroads, stagecoaches, highways, or planes. Usually the comment deals with railroads. Sometimes the comment is both charmed and charming, which is true of Father Raymond Bruckberger's account of his journey from Chicago to Minnesota in his recent book, One Sky to Share.
The journey would be worth the trouble if only for the train. Yesterday, in the Union Station at Chicago, an announcer was calling trains through a loudspeaker. It was like a psalmody. I listened to it, this pure sound, not at all hindered by its lack of meaning for me, and ended by feeling bewitched. Suddenly, as I made my way to the platform, an incoming train announced its arrival with a bell. A bell determined to make itself heard, as joyful as though it had just returned a bit late from Rome. Having thoughtlessly lost its way in these immense spaces. In the country, the trains call out with a sound between a whistle and a boom, ear-splitting as the roar and shriek of a ship's whistle. The large American Pullmans offer the illusion of a ship. A Negro porter took 10 minutes to show me all the secrets of my cabin. Push buttons, levers, chests, folding bed, a laboratory, and air conditioning. By a simple mechanical trick that uses space miraculously, I am at my wheel in a salon, a bedroom, or a bathroom. Lights, hot and cold water, air conditioning, peace, comfort, privacy, service. Everything is frighteningly perfect.
To balance Father Bruckberger's obvious pleasure in the luxuries of modern train travel in America, I should like to direct your attention to some British observations which date from a good many years back. Robert G. Athern recently published a most interesting book called Westward the Briton, in which he examines the comments made by British travelers in the United States between 1865 and 1900. There is quite inevitably a chapter on Western travel facilities, and I'm bound to say that the traveling Britisher of 60-odd years ago either had some pretty serious problems getting around the country, or he thought he did.
One of the chief annoyances to plague the British visitors was the possibility of being left at the station. One writer warned any prospective visitors to this country to be very quick in their movements because not only was there a lack of any warning, but the conductor, shouting all aboard, immediately jumps on board himself, and the train moves forward without any warning. This did not appear to annoy Americans, who, according to Lord Bryce, usually dropped off the cars before they had stopped and didn't get on again until they were in motion.
Hanging on like bees to the end of the tail car as it quits the depot.
The train conductor, who jumped aboard the train without properly notifying the passengers of the engineer's intentions, was not generally liked by the British.
What is the conductor? Is he a private gentleman traveling for his pleasure, a duke in disguise, or is he a servant of the company placed on the cars to see to the comfort of the company's customers?
Well, Rudyard Kipling had the answer to this question. The conductor was the train's chief authority, its captain. Kipling told of a passenger who refused to pay his fare and who grappled with this official, who neatly heaved him through a double plate glass window. The bleeding passenger was put off at the first stop, and the conductor volunteered the information that there was no profit in monkeying with the Northern Pacific Railway.
You can see from this that the Englishman represented in Mr. Athearn's book had a fairly exciting time in the course of their travels through the former colonies. You can also see, I trust, that Westward the Briton makes very pleasant and amusing reading. But we're not principally concerned tonight with the observations of visitors from abroad on our transportation system or anything else. I began by remarking that our book publishers, year by year, managed to issue a number of books which helped to satisfy our great domestic interest in the means of travel. One of the most interesting of these books in the present season was written by an Englishman, Alan Villiers. It deals with sailing vessels, and its title is The Way of a Ship. You have only to read as far as page 14 to encounter the clipper ship Champion of the Seas and the celebrated Black Ball line.
I serve my time on the Black Ball line, to me way, hey, hey, hurrah! In the Black Ball line, serve my time, hurrah for the Black Ball line. Oh, once there was a black ball ship, to me way, hey, hey, hurrah! That 14 knots an hour could clip, hurrah for the black ball line. You will surely find a rich gold mine, to me way, hey, hey, hurrah! Just take a trip in the black ball line, hurrah for the black ball line. Just take a trip to Liverpool, to me way, hey, hey, hurrah! To Liverpool, that Yankee school, hurrah for the black ball line. The Yankee sailors you'll see there, to me way, hey, hey, hurrah! With red top boots and short cut hair, hurrah for the black ball line, hurrah for the black ball line.
The Black Ball Line was the first great line of American packet ships to run between New York and Liverpool. The Black Ball ships had a bad reputation among sailors in the old days, but they did make some remarkably fast runs at sea. As Villiers says,
according to no less an authority than Lloyd's Calendar, which in its 1953 edition still had a section dealing with sailing ship records, the fastest day's run ever recorded under sail was made by the American-built clipper Champion of the Seas, which, when sailing for the Black Ball line, once claimed to have made good 465 nautical miles in one day. The master of the Champion, a Captain Alexander Newlands, said to have been a modest and reserved seaman of great integrity, was in the habit of presenting his passengers with a weekly statement of progress in his ship's newspaper. From the noon of December 11th to the noon of December 12th, 1854, while running her easting down, he reported the ship to have made 465 miles.
This would mean that the Champion had averaged something over 20 knots for the full day. When you consider that this is a considerably greater speed than most cargo ships do or can make today, you may be inclined to shake your head with Mr. Villiers and wonder if the captain of the Champion took his sights correctly. It's been nearly 15 years, Villiers says, since a sailing vessel put to sea under the American flag. At the end of the First World War, we had a number of sailing ships fit for sea, but they didn't stay in service long. Some of the last ships were sold to Japan for scrap. Some went to Hollywood for use in motion picture making. One or two of them wound up moored off Long Beach, serving as gambling ships. In 1939, only one sailing ship was left fit for sea. the Bark Kaiulani. She was the last sailing vessel to carry the American flag.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to hear you. Away, my rolling river. Oh, Shenandoah, I can't get near you. Away, away, I'm bound away, across the wide Missouri. Oh, Shenandoah, I love your daughter. Away, my rolling river. She lives beside the stormy water. Away, away, I'm bound away, across the wide Missouri.
At least one book appeared this fall which complements Mr. Villiers' The Way of a Ship very neatly. This book is Sidewheeler Saga by Ralph Nading Hill. This, of course, is the story of the Sidewheeler steamboat, from Robert Fulton's Claremont on down to the last surviving sidewheeler, the Ticonderoga. The story of the sidewheeler, as Mr. Hill recites it, is a tale of shocking disasters as well as great triumphs. I can't hope to do much more than pass on to you one or two samples from this book to give you some notion of the feel, the atmosphere of sidewheeler travel. The Claremont, of course, was the first steamer in regular service. The second was the Vermont, which thereafter made the trip from St. John's, Quebec, to Whitehall, New York, at a fast 4 knots. Passengers on the Vermont seem to have lived in a state of considerable confusion, which may or may not have been alleviated by the elaborate set of regulations established by her owners.
The great cabin of 16 berths, which will accommodate 24 persons, is for gentlemen. According to the order in which passengers pay their fare, they will be entitled to entry into the washroom. Cleanliness, neatness, and order are necessary. It is therefore not permitted that any person shall smoke in the ladies' cabin or in the great cabin, under the penalty first of $1.50 and $0.50 for each half hour they offend against the rule. The money to be spent in wine for the company. It is not permitted for any person to lie down in a berth with their boots or shoes on, under penalty of $1.50 and $0.50 for every half hour they may offend against this rule. Gentlemen are not permitted to sing or whistle the tunes of Clinton's March or Burgoyne's Defeat, as it may prove offensive to some of the company.
It's a long step from the comparatively scanty comforts of the Vermont to the gilded elegance some 50 years later of the ships of the Narragansett Steamship Company, whose president was Jim Fisk. Speculator, broker, dabbler in railroads and steamship lines, Fisk was one of the most extraordinary figures of his day. The label Robber Baron, which has been attached to his name, is possibly appropriate. Still, one must admit he had a nice taste in steamboats.
In 1869, the Boston, Newport, and New York Steamship Company, which owned the Fall River Line, was taken over by its rival, the Narragansett Steamship Company, whose president was now one James C. Fisk, Jr. The Vermont peddler, in his shrewd way, had come to control a line that had operated some of the finest sidewheelers in America, including the Bay State, Empire State, Metropolis, Old Colony, Newport, Bristol, and Providence, justifying a remark that a short time before would have seemed like wistful thinking. If Vanderbilt's a commodore, I guess I ought to rank as an admiral. After Fisk finished decorating his two new steamers, Bristol and Providence, with lavender paddle boxes and deep yellow smokestacks, they had to be seen to be believed. There were quarter decks of black walnut and yellow pine laid in strips, doors of rosewood, grand staircases of mahogany, and 300-foot gas-lighted saloons. To these, Fisk added carpet of velvet pile, white and gold trimmings, canaries in gilded cages in the saloons, and an orchestra
for each boat.
Of course, as everyone will remember, all this luxury didn't make the unfortunate Fisk in the least bulletproof, so that when a rival for the affections of the lovely Josie Mansfield shot him twice amidships, he died. And after a while, people made up a song about him in which he is described as a friend of the poor. Jay Gould, Fisk's partner, has also been saved for posterity in a folk tune, although not quite as affectionately.
On a Monday morning, it began to rain. Around the bend come a passenger train. On the bumpers was a hobo John. He's a good old hobo, but he's dead and gone. Dead and gone, dead and gone. He's a good old hobo, but he's dead and gone. Well, Jay Gould's daughter said before she died, there's one more road that I'd like to ride. Tell me, daughter, what can it be? In Southern California and the Santa Fe. Santa Fe, Santa Fe. It's in Southern California and the Santa Fe. Well, Jay Gould's daughter said before she died, father fix the blind so the bums can't ride. If ride they must, let them ride the ride. Let them put their trust in the hands of God. Hands of God, hands of God. Let them put their trust in the hands of God.
Mr. Benjamin Botkin has just turned up with another book, A Treasury of Railroad Folklore. Like Mr. Botkin's earlier folklore collections, the book is wonderful. I shall not attempt to describe it. I only want to borrow a short section or two from it. And I can't think of anything better to borrow than that epic of railroading, Finnegan to Flanagan.
Now, superintendent was Flanagan. Boss of the section was Finnegan. Whenever the cars got off the track and muddled up things to the devil and back, Finnegan writ it to Flanagan. After the rick was all on again. That is, this Finnegan reported to Flanagan. When Finnegan first writ to Flanagan, he rated 10 pages, did Finnegan. And he told just how the rick occurred. Many a tedious blundering word did Finnegan write to Flanagan. After the cars had gone on again. That's the way Finnegan reported to Flanagan. Now, Flanagan knowed more than Finnegan. He'd more education had Flanagan. And it wore him clean and completely out to tell what Finnegan writ about in his writing to Mr. Flanagan. So he writed this back. Mr. Finnegan, don't do such a sin again. Make him brief, Finnegan. Well, when Finnegan got that from Flanagan, he blushed rosy red, did Finnegan. And he said, ha, I'll gamble a whole month's pay that'll be many and many a day before superintendent, that's Flanagan, gets a whack at that very same sin again. From Finnegan to Flanagan, reports won't be that long again. Well, one day in the section of Finnegan and the road superintendent be Flanagan, a rail gave way and a bit of a curve and some cars went off as they made the swerve. There's nobody hurted, says Finnegan, but reports must be made to Flanagan. And he winked at McGorrigan as it married to Finnegan. Now, he was shantying then, was Finnegan, as many a railroader's been again. And his smoky old lamp was burning bright. Bylan Down's report was Finnegan. And he writed this here. Mr. Flanagan. Off again, on again. Gone again, Finnegan.
Like everyone else who writes about American railroading, Botkin speculates on the peculiar attraction it has for all of us. He writes,
with the passing of steam, an era, for many the great era of railroading, came to an end and passed into folklore. Those were the days, the roaring days, the restless, reckless, harum-scarum days, when rules, including Rule G, were too often honored in the breach rather than in the observance, while speed, comfort, and safety, the triple goal of railroad competition and public relations, often got in each other's way. Those were the days, too, of simple pleasures. The age of innocence, symbolized by the leisurely casualness and neighborliness of poky little locals on branch and short lines.
and old-fashioned depots in inland communities, ranging from a one-horse flag station in the middle of the prairie to a bustling railway town. If there were giants in those days, there were also little fellers. And the latter have a special place in the memories of old-timers because, among other reasons, he who travels by rail over the lesser lines of the USA clangs and shunts straight into his own childhood.
Perhaps this is, after all, the secret of our fascinated concern with the machines by which we get from here to there in America. Are we, in our loneliness and restlessness, only looking for a way back home? Thomas Wolfe, who thought and wrote a great deal of these matters, seems to have believed so. Or at least so I read his meanings in these lines from his novel Of Time and the River.
We're so lost, so naked and lonely in America. Immense and cruel skies bend over us, and all of us are driven on forever, and we have no home. Therefore, it is not the slow, punctual, sanded drip of the unnumbered days that we remember best, the ash of time, nor is it the huge monotone of the lost years, the unswerving schedules of the lost life, and the well-known faces that we remember best. No, it is a face seen once and lost forever in a crowd, an eye that looked, a face that smiled and vanished on a passing train. It is a prescience of snow upon a certain night, the laughter of a woman in a summer street long years ago. It is the memory of a single moon seen at the pine's dark edge in old October. And all of our lives is written in the twisting of a leaf upon a bough, a door that opened, and a stone. For America has a thousand lights and weathers, and we walk the streets. We walk the streets forever. We walk the streets of life alone.
America is the place of the howling winds, the hurrying of the leaves in old October, the hard, clean falling to the earth of acorns, the place of the storm-tossed moaning of the wintry mountainside, where the young men cry out in their throats and feel the savage vigor, the rude, strong energies. The place also where the trains cross rivers. It's a fabulous country, the only fabulous country. It's the one place where miracles not only happen, but where they happen all the time. It's the place of exultancy and strong joy, the place of the darkened brooding air, the smell of snow. It's the place of all the fierce, the bitten colors in October, when all the wild, sweet woods flame up. It's also the place of the cider press and the last brown oozing of the York Imperials. It's the place where great boats are baying at the harbor's mouth, where great ships are putting out to sea. It's the place where great boats are blowing in the Gulf at night, and where the river, the dark and secret river, full of strange time, is forever flowing by us to the sea.
The tugs keep baying in the river. At 12 o'clock, the Berengaria moans. Her lights slide gently past the piers beyond 11th Street. And in the night, a tall tree falls in old Catawba, there in the hills of home.
America is the place of autumnal moons hung low and orange at the frosty edges of the pines. It's the place of frost and silence, of the clean, dry shocks and the opulence of enormous pumpkins that yellow on hard, clotted earth. It's the place of the stir and feathery stumble of hens upon their roost, the frosty, broken barking of the dogs, the great barn shapes and solid shadows in the running sweep of the moon-whited countryside, the wailing whistle of the fast express. It's the place of flares and steamings on the tracks, and the swing and bob and tottering dance of lanterns in the yards. It's the place of dings and knellings and the sudden glare of mighty engines over sleeping faces in the night. It's the place of the terrific web and spread and smoldering, the distant glare of Philadelphia, and the solid rumble of the sleepers. It's also the place where the Transcontinental Limited is stroking 80 miles an hour across the continent, and the small dark towns whip by like bullets, and there's only the fan-like stroke of the secret, immense, and lonely earth again.
I have foreseen this picture many times. I will buy a passage on the fast express. I will go up and down the country and back and forth across the country on the great trains that thunder over America. I will go out west where states are square. Oh, I'll go to Boise and Helena and Albuquerque. I'll go to Montana and the two Dakotas and the unknown places.
America is the place of the fast approach, the hot, blind, smoky passage, the tragic, lonely beauty of New England, and the web of Boston, the place of the mighty station there, and the engines passive as great cats, the straight, dense plumes of engine smoke, the acrid and exciting smell of trains and stations, and the man swarm passing ever in its million-footed weft, the smell of the sea in harbors, and the thought of voyages, and the place of the goat cry, the strong joy of our youth, the magic city, when we knew the most fortunate life on earth would certainly be ours, that we were 20 and could never die.
And always, America is the place of the deathless and the enraptured moment. The eye that looked, the mouth that smiled and vanished, and the word, the stone, the leaf, the door we never found and never have forgotten. And these are the things that we remember of America, for we have known all her thousand lights and weathers, and we walked the streets forever. We walked the streets of life alone.
Have been listening to Americana, the 17th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Engineering by Ed Gott. Music supervision by Larry Johnson. Songs and ballads are by Chicago's well-known balladeer, Wynn Strutt. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Brisky. The books mentioned on tonight's program were Raymond L. Bruckberger's One Sky to Share, published by P.J. Kennedy, Robert Athern's Westward the Briton, and Alan Villiers' The Way of a Ship, both published by Charles Scribner's Sons. Sidewheeler Saga by Ralph Nading Hill, published by Reinhardt, and Benjamin Botkin's A Treasury of Railway Folklore, published by Crown. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is the NBC Radio Network.